That case having taken under advisement, and the sixth case is Georgie versus the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Mr. Beecraft.
May it please the court, Ms. Bradley. I'm Larry Beecraft, the counsel for the appellant, Christopher Georgie. I've been sitting here in the courtroom listening to all the other arguments, and I will tell the court that there's something quite obvious in this case. That all the other cases before this one are far more interesting and far more complex than this one. This is a very simple appeal. A very simple issue is presented, and involving very simple facts. And really, the case boils down to how you take the facts involved in this case and apply ordinary principles of law that have been well established for a long period of time, and that all has a relationship to mailing documents. Now, the common law had developed a real simple little rule of evidence regarding mailing of documents. If there was proof that a document was properly addressed, stuck into an envelope, had the right postage on it, was dropped in the United States mail, that created a presumption of mailing. Now, how does that presumption tie into the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code that are particularly applicable right here? Well, under Title 26 of the Internal Revenue Code, Section 6212, when the IRS contends that somebody owes additional taxes for a tax year, then it's going to send out a document called a Notice of Deficiency. Now, the statute itself just simply says, well, all that's required is that that document be mailed to the last known address.
Well, implicit in the tax court's findings is that he did not update the IRS with as many address changes. I need you to help me understand what's wrong with that finding, because it would seem irrational to believe his claim that he called the IRS or wrote those letters giving address updates. I mean, why would a man who has evaded filing a return for 14 years update the IRS with his new address?
Well, I could offer some other facts in contrast to that, Your Honor. I mentioned this in my reply brief, that there's a system of records that the IRS keeps that it can print out at any particular time. It's called the Information Returns Processing System. And, 1099s and W-2s are sent to the IRS all the time. That's available. The IRS has access to it by means of a computer. Now, the evidence in this case shows that, there was when the IRS was sending these notices of deficiency to an address that it contends was on the last return. Well, I will admit that, there was no last return that was filed in this case. The IRS is relying upon a computer document, a computer file, that incidentally can't be printed out. But nonetheless, the IRS does have access to a computerized system of records known as the Individual Returns Master File, and it has later information in it, 1099s. And offered in this case were for the years in question, didn't go all the way up to current, but there were a couple of years in which there was a computerized record offered to show all the other addresses of Mr. Georgie in later in time as a demonstration that, in fact, he had moved away from the address that the IRS contends is the last known address.
Is he contending that the Oakland address was his last known address?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the court.
I'm sorry. Is he contending that the Oakland address was his last known address?
No, Your Honor. There were other addresses that were, that Oakland address is what the IRS says is the address that was on his last return. Well, they didn't offer the last return in evidence. What they did is they offered a computerized system of records that contained that address. But then again, we do also know that computerized system records doesn't allow a hard copy to be printed out, even though there's a hard copy that was stipulated to in the evidence in this case. You know, we have in this case a subsequent computerized IRS system of records that has other addresses in it. So if the statute under Section 6212 says that the IRS shall mail a notice of deficiency to the last known address, and if they can pull up this computerized system of records that the IRS definitely has, then a last known address that might be or address in these later periods of time that is different from something that the IRS might have previously, I fail to see how that would qualify as, quote, last known address.
In other words, you're saying that your client gave him address but never got in the computer system.
Well, there, his, you know, maybe it's not all that weighty in the way of evidence, but he gave testimony to a tax court that, you know, he has a job that involves sales, that involves him moving around a lot. And if you look at his testimony that he gave before the tax court, yeah, he was moving around a lot. You know, there's this return that the IRS says was his last return in the year 2000. But boy, you can see from the computerized records, you know, 2001, 2002, 2003.
No proof of any calls or letters. He could not recall any details of when or even if he made the calls. He said it was all a blur.
Oh, that's true. But Your Honor, here's another issue that is implicit in this case. You know, there were three returns three tax years that were an issue, and one is not the subject of this appeal, the year 2001. And if you take a look at the decision of the tax court judge said, in referring to the only witness that was offered during the course of the proceedings in the tax court, there was a lady by the name of Ms. Dufek. Ms. Dufek was the only one that was offered to show, gee, here are the mailing of these documents. Well, in reference to the year 2001, the tax court found that she had no idea, she was incapable of offering testimony regarding either the preparation or mailing of notices of deficiency. And I will point out for the court, if you take a look at my opening brief and the required appendix, which includes the, you know, findings of facts of the district court, that particular spot is on page 44 of the opening brief.
Am I correct that he was allowed to substantively challenge the amount of the IRS assessments, and he failed to do so? In other words, he's only challenged whether the IRS mailed the notices to his last known address?
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct, that he had the opportunity to come in and you know, offer some documents or offer some testimony that would address, you know, what I made and what my expenses were and what tax liability was. That opportunity was there, and it was not taken. I will tell the court that. In light of the fact that I have my white light on, I would like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Ms. Beecraft, is there any challenge to any of Judge Parris's rulings?
I didn't hear the court.
Is there any challenge in your argument or brief to the judge's rulings, Judge Parris's rulings? I failed to find any.
Well, Your Honor, you know, that common law rule in reference to the mailing. And you know, the issue here in reference to 6330, you have a defense if there is a lack of receipt. And the lack of receipt, you know, I think is clear. But, you know, the problem here, when there's a lack of receipt, there's also the subsequent issue of, well, the lack of proof of mailing. And I maintain that there's absolutely, you know, there's a Welch case that I mentioned in my reply brief, in pages 11 and 12, that kind of outline what, you know, what the proof is regarding a proof of mailing. And, you know, even though we have the issue presented here about receipt, there wasn't any proof of mailing, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Speaker.
I'll reserve the rest.
All right. Ms. Bradley.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Janet Bradley, and I'm with the Justice Department. In this appeal, I would agree with my colleague that it actually should be fairly simple. This case arose as what's called a collection due process proceeding, and in the context of that, it allows a taxpayer to challenge it's a procedural protection when the IRS goes to administratively collect taxes that it deems owing by virtue of liens or levies. It's just protection for the taxpayer. And in the context of that hearing, the IRS settlement office will allow the taxpayer, if they did not receive a notice of deficiency, and there's no dispute here that the taxpayer claims that he didn't receive it, then Congress allows the taxpayer to challenge the underlying merits of the liability. The point being that if the taxpayer did never had an opportunity to challenge whether or not the termination of various amounts of income or deductions were correct, the taxpayer is allowed in the context of a CDP hearing to challenge whether or not they owe the taxes asserted. Here, counsel admitted this morning, the taxpayer here made no challenge whatsoever to the commissioner's determination that he received essentially, I think it was between about $150,000 and $170,000 for the 2 years at issue, and did not challenge his liability for the various penalties that were asserted, one being the failure to file returns, failure to pay estimated tax, and I'm missing one. In any event, he didn't challenge the additions to tax, and he didn't challenge any of this in his opening brief. Here the tax court found that to determine whether or not the deficiency notice was sent to the taxpayer, the statute at issue here, Section 6212A of the Code, requires that the commissioner send a notice of deficiency by certified or registered mail to the taxpayer's last known address. Here, under this court's own precedent, having addressed it before, it's where does the commissioner reasonably believe at the time he sends the deficiency notice is the taxpayer's last known address? And typically, if there is a return file and that year is audited, then it would be the year under audit. Here, however, as counsel admitted this morning, the taxpayer had not filed a return since the tax year 2000. The only thing in the record that taxpayer offered below in the trial of this case was some vague testimony regarding some purported phone calls, some purported letters. When push came to shove, he was unable to have any specific facts, didn't have any letters, didn't indicate that he did a change of address form with the IRS that would have notified
him of a difference. Has he been prosecuted for failing to file returns for 14 years? What is going on here?
Well, I guess that's the question the government would like to know. The government's burden, if we come after a taxpayer criminally, is a much higher standard that we must prove as opposed to in this context. And, of course, at the time that this case arose, going back to the year 2001, 2002, 2003, we honestly didn't have the benefit of hindsight that he didn't file returns for all the subsequent years. Here it's quite clear that by using the return that was the taxpayer identified on his last return, that was properly considered to be his last known address. And that's where we sent it. All of his testimony with different addresses, even the government was a little puzzled because we never could quite figure out which address he was specifically claiming. We assumed it was the Oakland address because in the tax court he did rely on this one letter, it's called a Are You There letter, that the service sent to him at an Oakland address to see if really that was his last known address. And as the tax court found, that really indicated that the last known address we had was in fact San Francisco. While taxpayer introduced that RUR letter and it was in the record, it wasn't properly completed. It wasn't checked. He didn't fill in his correct address. So we honestly wouldn't have known where he was. And to the extent counsel refers to addresses that the IRS may have received on informational returns from his employer, from his bank, from his broker. There's a multitude of addresses on these, of which the San Francisco address that we use was there. So we were actually trying to find where are you?
Why is this case in this court in Chicago?
At the time the taxpayer filed his petition, I believe he was living in Evanston, Illinois.
Okay.
So that's the reason we're here, not in the Ninth Circuit. So that's the reason we're here before the court. So in sum, the tax court
So where is he now?
I would have to ask counsel to speak of that. I really wouldn't know now in 2014 where he is. And probably with the subsequent years at issue, you know, this is going to be a challenge for the service to determine where he is. But
this
as
is a movie.
This is a movie. He in fact did move around, admittedly, constantly. Sometimes he even used the address for his employer on documents. I think it could be reasonably assumed that he didn't really want the IRS to know where he was. And the service reasonably relied on the address on his 2000 return. He obviously could have filed returns for the years at issue choosing a different address, and at that point that would have been proper notice to the service. That's typically the way taxpayers change their address unless they go ahead and send a change of address form. So here, the tax court, we had a trial. We gave Mr. Jayorgi ample opportunity to explain what he would have done to provide clear and concise notice to the IRS that he had a different address. The tax court fully considered it, and we would ask this court just to affirm the decision of the tax court. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Speaker.
I'll be brief, but to answer the court's question about why this case is here, I just was looking at my brief. I thought maybe I had that fact in there. It seems like it's about 2006 or 2007 he moved from California to Evanston. And at the time that the IRS sent out these notices of liens, which authorized him to pursue the statutory procedure, he was living in Evanston. So that's it. And the tax court proceeding, you know, happened here, so that's the reason why this is a Seventh Circuit case. But, you know, I think what's really relevant about this boring case involving mailings, you know, what's really important is that, you know, descending to specifics, like other courts have done in reference to the evidence and rules regarding mailing, I would suggest that the Welch against United States case, which I mentioned on page 11 and 12 of my reply brief, is something that's really important for this case. I think one of the reasons why we're having oral arguments is, you know, for that reason. I think that that case outlines the real evidence that's required in order to show, and this court ought to follow Welch. I want to thank the court for being allowing me to come.
Thank you.
We want to thank you for listening to all those cases today.
The court. They were very interesting.
Yeah, they were, weren't they?